you can explore an exclusive collection of case law at Decisus Law Reports. Browse a comprehensive collection of nearly 14,000 reports of Irish legal judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisus.ie to find out more.
Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 69 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard, barrister.
Myself, Mark Tottenham, barrister and editor of Decisus Law Reports.
Mark, good to see you as always. And last week, we had a fantastic interview with solicitor Paul Egan, who is a partner in Mason Hayes & Curran. I should say senior counsel, Paul Egan.
Senior counsel and former performer of Tubular Bells and other Mike Oldfield classics.
He very kindly gave us a CD as he was leaving. I had a listen to it. It is fantastic. The French album. Really, really fabulous. What a talented man. I was going to say wasted in law, but not really. I mean, he's so successful in law, so he wasn't wasted at all. But that was fantastic. Really, really enjoyed that interview with Paul. Clio is the leading provider of cloud-based legal practice management software, providing lawyers with an easy-to-set-up, affordable solution to manage and grow your firm more effectively, more profitably, and with better client experiences. Start a free trial today. Visit clio.com/IE.
Well, tonight we are talking to Liam Herrick, Executive Director of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties. And we're going to talk about the big issue at the moment, which is getting a lot of media coverage, and that's the Criminal Justice Incitement to Violence or Hatred and Hate Offences Bill 2022, Mark, which is getting a lot of coverage at the moment and people are getting very excited about it, aren't they?
Well, I think in light of the Scottish legislation, which has been very controversial, people are now looking at this legislation and thinking maybe it's not meeting what is required and people will be aware of the J.K. Rowling issue.
Yes, of course. Well, we're going to discuss that with Liam, I presume, and very much looking forward to that. But first, we go to three cases that you have identified from the Decisus website. And the first is a challenge to a wind farm on the basis that its operation constituted a nuisance due to excessive noise and vibration impacting residents. They weren't able to sleep at night, no doubt. Apparently, people were giving out about it on a regular basis. And this is the case of Webster versus Mean a Clocks Bar Wind Limited, and this is a High Court decision of Justice Egan.
Yeah, so this is, as you said, this is a private nuisance action, which basically means that your enjoyment of life is adversely affected by the alleged nuisance. And the claim was brought by various neighbours who said that the noise and vibration was affecting their quality of life. And I think the decision of the court is well summed up by this quotation. As Justice Egan said, The WTN causes a serious adverse noise impact exceeding reasonable tolerability by a substantial margin, and our concluding remarks on nuisance that regeneration of renewable energy is a socially valuable activity, but it should not come at the cost of a good night's sleep for its neighbours.
Okay, well, next to the case on an issue of delay, and this case concerned whether a claim which had not been advanced since 2009 could still be advanced, so to speak. Again, this case concerned nuisance proceedings, as water had escaped from the defendant's premises and it caused damage to the plaintiff's premises. Was there inordinate delay in this case, Mark?
Well, the settlement agreement was 2009 in this case, and there had been minimal progress over 12 years. And basically, the particular issue here was that one of the defendants had given an indemnity against the other defendants. And in the meantime, that the defendant who'd given the indemnity had entered a personal insolvency arrangement. So the other defendants were seriously prejudiced because of the delay. Because if the plaintiff had brought the proceedings, had completed the proceedings earlier, they could have relied on the indemnity. But as it happened, they would have been personally liable for the damage.
Okay.
And so the plaintiff's claim was dismissed.
And I should say that's the case of Coughlin and Stokes, a 2024 decision of Mr. Justice Mulcahy in the High Court. So finally, to a case involving witness security programs, and in particular, the participant's request for new identity certificates. The individual in question wanted a new birth certificate and a new marriage certificate, and obviously the new name, the alias or whatever it is. And the court had to consider this, Mark. This is the case of Doe versus the Commissioner of An Garda Síochána. And again, it's a decision of Mr. Justice Mulcahy.
Yeah, it's a curious one because we've discussed before this witness relocation program where basically people very often are transferred to other countries and given new identities. But the issue here was the the witness wanted himself and his spouse and his family to all have new birth certificates. Problem is that there isn't much of a legislative basis for this witness relocation program. And what the court said was that the people have to rely on the register of births, marriages and deaths, and you can't just interfere with it and give people new identities without a legislative basis for it. And so the claim was dismissed.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, back shortly with Liam Herrick.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
We are delighted to be joined in the studio today by Liam Herrick, who is the Executive Director of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties. We are going to talk today about the new hate speech legislation, which or was commonly called the hate speech legislation. But before that, maybe, Liam, we'll ask you a little bit about yourself and about the ICCL. So, Liam, you have a background, I think, both working for the Department of Foreign Affairs and for the President of Ireland. Is that correct?
A little bit, yeah. I studied law. I got a master's from UCC in 1999. So quite a while ago, I suppose, now. And for most of the intervening time, I've worked kind of in law reform. Some of that for the public service. So I worked for the Law Reform Commission, Department of Foreign Affairs, and I worked as an advisor for the president for about 3 years.
As legal advisor?
As a general advisor. I mean, maybe people don't appreciate that the office of the president isn't a very large office of state. Sure. So there's not a very significant number of staff. So I would have been advising across all the areas of his constitutional functions. But for most of my career, I've been working in the independent not-for-profit sector, working on law reform. So both for the Penal Reform Trust for 7 years, now I'm 7 years in this role with ICCL. I also worked for ICCL at one point in the past. And I work for the Independent Human Rights Commission for a number of years as their head of law and policy too.
And Liam, can I just ask you about just working for Michael D. Higgins? I think a lot of people would be very interested to know how that comes about. Was it a case of him getting on the phone and giving you a bell and saying, Liam, come join me? Or was it a case of you as a public servant automatically finding yourself in that office?
No, I wasn't a public servant. I was the director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust, an independent human rights organisation. In that capacity, I would have known President Higgins because he's a very strong interest in prison reform, going way back to his academic career. So the position of advisor became vacant in his team. And he contacted me and we had a couple of chats and we had mutual interest, I suppose. So it was really fascinating to work with him for a number of years. I mean, I think the thing about the Office of President in our constitutional framework, obviously it's a non-executive head of state role, but the head of state touches on every aspect of the public administration of the country. Like this week, for example, President will be involved in the appointment of a new Taoiseach and a new government. Mm-hmm. Obviously appoints judges and interacts with all of the offices of state in various ways and obviously has a particular role with regard to legislation. So whereas you don't have the spending and lawmaking function directly, except obviously in the specific legislative function, you touch on every aspect of the way the country is run and you get a really interesting insight into all aspects of public life.
And the president does really kind of personify the country, doesn't he? I mean, in terms of, you know, signing legislation, making key appointments, whatever. I mean, he basically is the representing the people in terms of that. I mean, I was going to say rubber stamping function, but it's a little bit more than that, isn't it?
I think it's a lot more than that. I mean, I worked with President Higgins when he carried out the first ever state visit from an Irish head of state to the United Kingdom in 2014. And I mean, it really came home to me then. I mean, what distinguishes us from our nearest neighbour is that we choose our head of state. We choose who represents us at an emblematic level on the world stage. And that's in very stark contrast, obviously, to the situation in that jurisdiction. Yeah. And I think there was a real sense of pride among most of us that were there, I think, on that visit to really see that distinction, you know, being borne out. And we've obviously been particularly well served by our presidents in terms of that they obviously enjoy a democratic mandate, but also a huge popular mandate, I think, in terms of the support that all of the presidents have had. And long may that continue.
What about the element of controversy, dare I say it, in relation to Michael D, where he has been deemed, and I'm not trying to get you to say anything dramatic here, this isn't Morning Ireland, but, you know, where he has maybe strayed beyond what traditionally and what would be contained in the Constitution is the role of the president, and has commented on matters that are of, I'm sure, obvious public importance. Yeah. Where do you stand on all of that?
I mean, I think it's a little bit like maybe the subject matter we're going to discuss today. There is the real law and what the Constitution says and the legal parameters as or restrictions as they exist, and sometimes those that are as imagined by the commentariat. I mean, the only restriction on the utterances of the president in the Constitution relate to his address to the House of the Oireachtas, where there's a formal provision that he has to seek the approval of government to do so. But with regard to the other comments and utterances of the president, there's no such restriction.
Does he not have to run it by the government before he makes a statement?
No, and I think this is an incredible misconception that seems to be out there. That is a complete misconception. There's one specific provision in the Constitution with regard to an address to the Oireachtas. And it's amazing to see commentators coming up with this, you know, were his comments approved by the government? There's no requirement that they should be. And in fact, if you look at the way the office of president has evolved within our constitutional system, particularly since 1990, you know, the public are very clear that they are electing somebody who is not just a rubber stamp on our legislative process. They're electing somebody to be an intellectual leader of the state in many respects. Now, there is a balance between the executive function and the office of the president, and obviously he should not or she should not intervene on matters of contemporary, you know, political controversy, particularly with regard to legislation that's being developed or considered. And sometimes that line can be, you know, difficult to manage. But there's certainly no suggestion in any serious constitutional analysis, I think, that the government has to approve the statements of the president. And I think what you've seen in recent years is that this president, his statements and comments very often are closer perhaps to the will and preferences of the people than maybe the elected government is at times.
And if we can bring you back then to the work that you're currently doing with the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, a lot of people will be aware of the ICCL. But just a little bit of background. I think it was founded by Cadair Asmal, isn't it right?
Yeah, I mean, Cadair was probably the driving force behind it. ICCL was established in 1976 at the heart of the conflict in Northern Ireland with the Troubles. It was a direct response to concern among legal practitioners, legal academics, journalists and others about the way emergency legislation was being introduced in this jurisdiction and being abused. It was set up in the spring of 1976, immediately after the Salins train robbery and the interrogation of suspects in that case, including torture, and also at the time that the 1976 emergency powers legislation was being proposed, which of course led to the resignation ultimately of President O'Dolig. Yeah. So it was a time of, you know, heightened concerns about civil liberties, counterterrorism legislation. The driving force was Cadair Asmal. If for listeners who are not familiar with Cadair, he was the law lecturer in Trinity College Dublin who had moved to Ireland from South Africa.
He was effectively a refugee, wasn't he? He was a member of the ANC.
He was a member of the ANC, and he was a very significant figure in the international ANC movement, obviously most of whom were in exile at that time. He had been in London briefly and then was in Dublin for many years. He was a founder of the Irish anti-apartheid movement, which is what he is most well known for. Yeah. But as part of that work, he also set up the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, along with people like Mary Robinson, Donald Barrington, and others that were involved at the time, and obviously went on to play very prominent roles in the legal system subsequently. I mean, ICCL was always concerned with matters to do with policing and the criminal justice system, but also on social issues, would have played a key role in the referendums in the 1980s and 90s on abortion, divorce, and so on.
You know. And Liam, if I can annoy you in relation to that, just civil liberties themselves. I mean, people have notions as to what civil liberties are. Would you give us in a nutshell what you would describe as civil liberties?
Yeah, I mean, there's an ongoing controversy about the distinction between civil liberties and human rights. If you like, civil liberties, I suppose, as I would see it, are a subset within human rights, tend to deal with those civil and political rights primarily that are more associated with free and open societies. So freedom of expression, democratic rights, the right to protest, and the right in terms of privacy and personal freedom in terms of your interaction with state agencies. So I suppose the classic civil liberties issues that we would have been involved in during that time would have included censorship issues, the political censorship that we had in Ireland in the 1980s, the right to protest, police powers.
Political censorship being Section 31.
Section 31,
so
the broadcasting
where members of Sinn Féin weren't able to speak in the press.
Yeah. And ICCL would have campaigned against it. And of course, also actually separately, President Higgins and his then role as an elected representative was one of the key opponents of that. And he had the opportunity then, when he became a minister of government in the 1990s, to sign the final papers to repeal Section 31 of the Broadcasting Act.
And so speaking of freedom of speech, I think this brings us neatly to what we're really here to talk about, which is the legislation currently pending before the Oireachtas, which is the Criminal Justice Incitement to Violence or Hatred and Hate Offences Bill 2022, which is designed to replace the existing Prohibition of Incitement to Hatred Act 1989. So I suppose if you can briefly tell our listeners, what is the new legislation going to do that the previous Incitement to Hatred Act did not do?
Well, I think first of all, it's effectively two bills rolled into one, or two quite separate but connected issues are being addressed in the same piece of legislation. One is to do with incitement to hatred provisions, the amendment of the 1989 Act, and the introduction for the first time in Irish law of provisions relating to hate crime. That is, ordinary crimes such as assaults, arson, damage to property, up to murder, which have an additional hate element.
Hate being hate of people because of what they are, whether it be their race, their religion, their ethnic background.
Because of protected characteristics that they may have. And obviously the idea of protected or personal characteristics is not new. It's something very familiar in terms of discrimination and equality law, which we've had for a number of decades. But this is specifically in a criminal justice context. I think in the introduction you refer to it as the hate speech bill. It used to be referred to as the hate crime bill, but that's maybe one of the ways the politics of this particular piece of legislation have played out. So the hate crime part of this, we're one of the very few European countries that doesn't have specific hate crime legislation. There's a European Framework Directive from the early 2000s, which directs member states to have legislation with regard to hate crime. We're somewhat in default from not having done that. It's been in the United Kingdom, for example, and other common law jurisdictions for many years. And the idea of having specific criminal justice legislation and provisions that address the additional hate element of what you might call ordinary crime is a fairly well-established idea. The purpose really is to allow criminal justice agencies to record and monitor this as a particular problem within the criminal justice system, and then develop effective responses, including special ways of dealing with such cases before the courts, which may mean aggravated sentences or special provisions. For example, you know, not just necessarily a longer sentence, but maybe directing that somebody be sent for education or training or whatever it might be appropriate in the circumstances. And in fact, this part of the bill has been fairly uncontroversial.
Yeah.
And Garda Síochána have said that it would be helpful to them to allow them to develop proper ways of monitoring hate crime, which they already try to do, but don't have a clear legislative framework to do so, and also to develop strategies for dealing with this problem in society. It's also a problem that affected communities, minority communities, are reporting is on the rise, that there's a rise in homophobic violence, there's a rise in racist violence. There's an increasing sensitivity about misogyny and women being targeted for as victims of crime because of their gender. So I think that part of the bill would be seen as a useful evolution of our criminal justice system to deal with something that we failed to deal with up to now.
Liam, could I tease this out with you a little bit? I mean, I think it is pretty clear, let's say, if somebody sets fire to a hotel that is accommodating refugees, for example, or asylum seekers, that, you know, you can make the connection between hate and between a protected characteristic and the crime that's involved. But what about other stuff, like, for example, an assault that might take place in O'Connell Street at 2 o'clock in the morning, where two people end up getting in a fight and, you know, language is used about one of the persons, you know, maybe there is a different race involved, etc. and a racial characteristic is identified in the course of some sort of violence, mm-hmm. does that automatically merit an aggravated sentence then?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question because this has been one of the things that has been a subject of academic discussion in Ireland, but perhaps not political contestation, whether we adopt a test of demonstration or motivation. So in the instance and the circumstances you're talking about, a confrontation, a crime might be committed, an assault might be committed, and in the commission of that offence, words might be articulated which would indicate that there was hostility or hate against that person because of their characteristics. That's a demonstration test which could be using that information to lead to somebody being convicted of a hate crime. The alternative test is a test of motivation, that there must be evidence adduced that the person was motivated by hate or animosity yes. before they committed the offence, that it was the purpose or it was intrinsic
so
in the offence.
So it's the old-fashioned mens rea.
Indeed. Mm.
So not instinctive reactions, etc., yeah, in the heat yeah. of the moment, for example.
Yeah, and this is something that has been debated in the academic literature in Ireland. The government, it seems at this point, is preferring the demonstration approach, the demonstration test, that comments of that type pertaining to the circumstances of the and the environment in which the offence took place could be used as evidence of that hate element. I have to say, you know, in the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, our original preference would have been that retaining a requirement of motivation may have been preferable. I think a lot of this is going to have to be, you know, measured really, and when we see the legislation being enforced.
Can I bring you to the more controversial aspect of the bill, which seems to be, well, there's two controversial aspects really, but first of all, the incitement to hatred aspect, where I think it's broadened over the previous act, isn't it? I mean, they certainly broadened the characteristics, and of course, the particularly controversial one is that of gender. But is the offence of incitement of hatred changing radically between the old act and the new legislation?
Well, radically, no, I wouldn't say so. I mean, we have to kind of just remember context here. We have the Incitement to Hatred Act since 1989. Yeah. We're not introducing anything new, any concepts that are new to Irish law. That's not the impression one would get from some of the discussion around this. So in terms of what's different about this bill with regard to the incitement to hate provisions and what was in the 89 Act, some is quite logical, I think, and easy to understand. There were provisions in the European Framework Decision and in other international treaties which require states to introduce specific provisions to incitement to hatred where it relates to genocide or the denial of a genocide taking place. So there's a number of international treaties which require us to do that. So that's something that we're going to introduce.
Can we come back to the genocide bit? Because that's a separate offence, isn't it, under this Act?
It is, with regard to incitement. It does extend the characteristics because the 1989 Act was introduced before the Equal Status Act, the Employment Equality Act. So I think one of the most significant additions is incitement on the basis of disability and incitement on the basis of gender being two key ones. That's really to bring us in line with other legislation which deals with these questions.
And do they relate back to the European legislation, or are they introduced in the specifically in the Irish?
They do. Right. And then there's also the question of the test for the criminal offence itself.
Yeah.
And I think this is where we've seen that the 1989 Act effectively has led to virtually no successful prosecutions, a very small number of cases, and very few of them leading to convictions over the years. And there is a view from, and there's been research on this from the criminal justice agencies themselves, that that's because it has required the prosecution to prove both an intention and a likelihood that there would be an effect of incitement. So we've had instances where people have been involved in offering racial slurs around the commission of an offence. There seem to be indications that they were motivated by that animosity, but courts couldn't be satisfied that there were real life people that were actually incited as a result of that statement. And so, that test is very, very high.
So the intention to lead somebody to carry out an offence isn't sufficient.
There had to be a likelihood that a real person would be incited.
Right.
So I suppose one of the examples that's cited quite a lot when we look at this is that there was an instance where an individual had set up a Facebook page and the messages on the Facebook page were directing that travellers or children from the traveller community should be used as shark bait. That was the message that he was putting up. That was the core message. And that he was exploring other ways in terms of various messages that travellers could be denied their basic right to life and fundamental rights. It was quite extreme messaging.
Yeah.
An attempt was made, complaints were made, the guards investigated, files were sent to the DPP, and ultimately in the district court, view was taken that unless the court could be satisfied that there were people that were actually incited to try to commit offences against travellers.
So even something as extreme as that
something
was
as extreme
not
as that.
Considered to be incitement to hatred.
Yeah, okay. And I think that that is a fairly useful example of how the current 89 Act has not in effect been used by the criminal justice system.
And how would the new Act change that?
Yeah, so the idea would be that if a person intended to incite or was reckless as to whether their statements were likely to cause incitement, that there wouldn't be a requirement that you would prove that it was likely that particular individuals were so incited.
Yeah, that would appear, like, I mean, the 1989 Act, as you've said, and that's a really interesting example. I mean, it was overly onerous to get a prosecution in that sense because you had to say, were you influenced by what this individual said? And the person says, oh, no, I wasn't. And the court didn't seem to know where to go with that. So saying it in itself and it being outrageous and something that incites hatred is enough under the new legislation?
That's the intention. And I mean, I suppose, you know, practitioners in the field will be aware that what in reality happens then is when those type of difficulties are presented, that the criminal justice agencies, in particular the guards, will then move away from trying to deal with an incident in that sphere and deal with it under other legislation, public order legislation or other legislation. So you lose the hate element. It becomes invisible. The incitement element or the hate element becomes invisible in the criminal justice system. It means it's not adequately recorded. We can't have a proper sense of how big the problem is in society. And the guards and the other agencies can't develop proper strategies for dealing with it.
And Liam, I mean, obviously, as you said earlier, when I asked you what were civil liberties, one of the first things you said was freedom of expression and people should be allowed to express themselves, etc. And that's fundamental and, you know, central to your view of things. And yet you are fully in favour of this legislation. You see that this legislation is a valuable contribution to the Irish legislature.
Yeah.
And, you know, are you surprised at this kind of kickback and reaction that is emerging at the moment?
Yeah, well, we're fully in favour of what it's trying to achieve. But what's happened with this legislation is kind of interesting that since it was introduced in the Oireachtas, and I mean, I have to say, like, that there was a consultation process that preceded it run by the Department of Justice, which included a review of the 1989 Act and why the 1989 Act hadn't been effective. There have been submissions from all their main agencies. It was a public consultation. And when the bill was published, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, our colleagues in the Coalition Against Hate Crime and Civil Society, academics and others, all made recommendations identifying strengths and weaknesses in the legislation. And particularly with regard to the incitement to hatred provisions, we identified that there were ways in which it was weak, that the protections for freedom of expression weren't as strong as they should be. And indeed, amendments were proposed by TDs from all parties to that effect. So we're in favour of what it's trying to achieve, but we think that there's flaws in it. And I think what's been disappointing is that in the Doyle debates, the government didn't really engage with any of those proposed amendments. Okay. And they were coming from left and right. I mean, they're coming from people like Paul Murphy and backbenchers and Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
When I hear you talking about that and, you know, the suggestion that the government didn't engage and hasn't sold the idea to the public out there and that there's uncertainty and people are saying, well, what does hate mean and how do you define the word hate and all that sort of stuff? It's reminding me of the two referendums that we recently had, you know, where this notion was it's too vague, we can't go for it. But is there a cultural backdrop here, Liam? Like, I mean, what are you seeing in society? Is there a little bit of a kickback in Ireland at the moment? You know, I mean, it's amazing how, you know, with the election, I suppose, or, you know, it wasn't an election, but the assumption of Simon Harris as leader of Fine Gael, straight away, Charlie Flanagan came out and said, get rid of this hate bill. you know, Michael Ring. This was kind of one of the first things. Sinn Féin now have turned their back on it. I mean, it's what's going on? What's going on out there?
Yeah, all people who voted for the legislation in the Dáil, you know, I mean, I'll posit a suggestion about the referendums and we could be a separate discussion about analysing that. But I think one of the things the referendums showed is that the Irish people, when questions are put to them about the legal protections in the Constitution, they're primarily interested in the legal effects of what's being proposed.
Yeah.
You know? And in fairness to people like Michael McDougall and others in the course of the debate, they argued about what the legal effect of the two proposals would be. Now, you can disagree with their analysis. You can say some of it was a little bit fanciful, but at the same time, they were debating about the law. And the public are very interested in having an analysis about what the legal effect will be. Now, I think in this legislation, there are questions about the legal effect of what's being proposed. There's a number of specific areas in the bill, which I think the current draft of the legislation is problematic. One of which is it's implicit that the freedom of expression rights in the Constitution and the European Convention on Human Rights are a defence in this proposed criminal justice legislation. But it would be better that that was made explicit.
Yeah.
There's also the question of they're trying to create an offence relating to somebody who's in possession or has produced or prepared material which might lead to incitement in the future. Now, the idea is a sound one, that they want to try to, if somebody has a plan to create incitement, for example, they've prepared this material and they're about to broadcast it on a radio program, or they're about to go to a demonstration and hand out flyers which call for violence against members of a minority community, the guards want to be able to intercept them before they carry out the act of distribution. Yeah. That's sensible. But unless you define that very closely, you open up the vista that somebody in the privacy of their own home who has produced and is reading hateful material but might never actually share it with anybody else, well, they shouldn't be interfered with. So, you know, that's a second problem. And the third, and I think probably most difficult question, is whether you define the words hate, hatred, or incitement to hatred in the interpretation section of the legislation itself. And what government is saying on that is that they have very strong advice, both from this Attorney General and the previous Attorney General, that it's not appropriate to define the terms in legislation, that these are concepts that are not unknown to the criminal law, and that the courts are more appropriate to have some flexibility. And I think there, Peter, you're right, because there's a resonance there with the discussion around the constitutional referendums, where the public like more certainty. It is a technical legal point.
Yes.
But it is a significant one.
Isn't that the issue, Liam? I mean, of course, and I mean, you have brilliantly explained, you know, potential flaws in the legislation. But is there such thing as a council of perfection? I mean, can you cover every little kind of iota of legislative impact in terms of a bill and a piece of legislation like this? And therefore, are we losing the greater good if we drill down into all these little bits and say, well, I'm not sure what that means, and I'm not sure what that means? And I suppose what the bigger question I'm asking is, how is the wind blowing in this country at the moment? You know, what is happening? People seem to have problems with concepts that I think a while ago a lot of us felt that, you know, Irish people would embrace very easily and very comfortably.
Well, I mean, I suppose there are real legal questions which need to be teased out, and there are reasonable arguments for and against, you know, different approaches to this technical question. And I mean, certainly there are people in the Oireachtas who, if they feel that the government doesn't either introduce or accept amendments on these types of questions, that maybe the freedom of expression protections aren't strongly enough, and on balance, you either want to vote for or vote against. But then you have people that aren't bringing forward any amendments or have voted for it in previous stages and aren't talking about amendments or fixing or balancing rights. They're just saying drop it because it's too woke. And that's trying to, I suppose, rather than actually do the hard work of discussing the legislation and the legal questions, to wrap this into some type of culture war.
Yeah.
And I think that there is that tendency there. Yeah.
And with that in mind, can I just ask you about the Scottish legislation? Because that's been in the news quite a lot recently. They brought in a new hate speech, hate crime bill, whatever you want to call it. And J.K. Rowling was very prominent in effectively, to sum up, I mean, she highlighted a number of trans women and described them as men and more or less said, come and arrest me for doing it. And I think the response of the Scottish government was what she said may have been offensive, but it certainly didn't constitute a crime. Is there a difference between the Scottish legislation that has received so much controversy and the legislation that we're looking at bringing in here?
I mean, there are some differences. They're not, you know, they're not different animals. They are similar in some respects. Scotland also has had incitement hatred legislation for quite some time. It's not, you know, a very significant change to their law. There is this question of adding new characteristics, but many of which they had already. In some ways, the Scottish legislation is a bit more complicated.
They use the term stir up hatred as opposed to incite hatred. I don't know if there's any difference there.
Yeah, and they also, and obviously Scottish legal language tends to be a little bit archaic and maybe different from ours in some respect. They also seem to require an element of using offensive language in the construction of their criminal offences. And they have a different standard with regard to racial hatred and hatred on other protected grounds, which I think is, you know, it's a product of the fact that legislation on racial hatred is older in the United Kingdom than on other grounds. So I think their legislation is more complex than ours. It may prove difficult to operate. But I mean, they're not completely different. But again,
I suppose in terms of a, you know, there obviously is a live debate, whether one likes it or not, over issues to do with transgender issues. And is there a danger that legislation of this sort will stifle that kind of debate?
I mean, I don't think the treatment of that particular area of either hate crime against the trans community or incitement to hatred against that community or the questions of freedom of expression about people having a view on what policy might be with regard to trans people, whether that's to do with education or prisons or whatever it might be. I don't think that they are materially different. The politics of it is different, all right?
Sure.
Because, I mean, you know, certainly this has been a wedge issue in Britain for a number of years, and in recent years it has become so here. Like we as an organisation are, you know, completely committed that it's appropriate to have legislation which deals with hate crime against trans people because it is a real problem in society.
Sure.
But I don't think, I mean, what you're seeing in Scotland is that there are not prosecutions resulting from this.
Yeah.
What she's doing is pretty hateful and distasteful and targeting people that are in a minority community to try to, you know, whip up public animosity against them. It may not meet the threshold of incitement to hatred. It doesn't mean it's right.
Yeah.
And I think some of the media commentary is certainly aimed at being divisive rather than being inclusive.
Sure. Unfortunately, we've come towards the end of our time, Liam, but we have the question that we like to ask all of our guests, which is, do you have a book or a film or TV series or podcast that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Yes, we could talk all day about that, but there's actually a book that I'm reading at the moment, which will be familiar to a lot of your readers. It was very popular last year, Martin Doyle's book, Dirty Linen, about, so it's not a legal book as such.
But it's experience growing up in the north, isn't that it?
Yeah. It's experience growing up in his particular rural parish in Tullyleish, which, as he says in the book, was known as the Linen Triangle, but subsequently became known as the Murder Triangle during the Troubles. The area around Portadown, Lurgan, and Newry, and the particular concentration of deaths that happened in the Troubles at the time. It's a very, very moving book. It really is. It talks about the various atrocities that took place, the collusion with the security forces, which was very concentrated in that area because of the Glenan gang.
And the various people he knew who were killed or caught up in these issues.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people that were truck drivers that were blown up at customs posts because of IRA bombs that went off early, people who were assassinated by members of the UVF and their homes. It's really moving. And it's really in my mind at the moment because we have the UK Legacy Bill, Legacy Act now. And we have the Irish state bringing the British state, the European Court of Human Rights, because human rights violations that do not lead to truth are an ongoing human rights violation and a denial of justice. Why I think it's an important book for all of us living in Ireland is that the issues are front and centre now about the UK government trying to suppress the truth of what happened in the north. But there are a lot of circumstances in which the authorities in the south have suppressed investigation of the truth of what happened here. And I'm not just talking about the Troubles. I'm not just talking about cases like the Salins case, where we still haven't had the truth of what happened.
Kelly, yes.
Yeah. But, you know, we have the Kerry Babies case. We have other cases related to the so-called heavy gang within an Garda Síochána.
Mark, we're going to have to have him back.
I think we will.
Great recommendation.
It's a book that you can't help but be moved, but it opens lots of other questions about if you are somebody who, a member of your family or your community was killed in those circumstances, your campaign for truth is never going to end until justice is served. And there's a lot of people living on this island, north and south, that have not got the truth of what happened to their family members.
Liam Herrick, thank you very much for joining us here in the Fifth Court.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
And that's all from this edition of The Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Can we say a huge thank you to our guest, Liam Herrick, Executive Director of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties. Mark, what an interview.
Yeah, very interesting. Obviously his background is interesting, but I think that it's always tricky when you come across an organisation like that, that obviously, on the one hand, that part of their function is to protect free speech, but then you have the issue of people who are facing serious discrimination and how you balance that.
I thought it was a fabulous discussion about a topic that seems to be exercising the public at the moment. We'll have to see how that plays out. Before I go, I'd like to say a big thank you to our producer, Cunnell O'Moroyne, and to Alison of the Dublin South Podcast Studios for her wonderful work in recording this show. So from me, Peter Leonard.
And myself, Mark Tottenham.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.
Never miss a vital Irish legal judgment. Check out Decisis Law Reports, where you'll find a fully indexed collection of all Irish judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisis.ie to find out more.